Coming up, David Taraschuk on what the United States can learn from Britain about fighting terrorism.
You've got to swallow a bit of pride and say, yes, we have a homegrown problem.
And the rapid growth in the number of evangelical Protestants who are Hispanic.
God is saying, I've got the money. I got the resources. What I need is a church that's willing to meet the needs of these people.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Deborah Potter, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Faith communities across the country reacted this week to the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black teenager. Demonstrations against the verdict were mostly peaceful. Some ministers organized vigils to press for federal civil rights charges against Zimmerman. The president of the National Council of Churches said people of faith should join in a renewed call for racial justice. Joining us to talk about all this are Kim Lawton, managing editor of this program, and the Reverend Ramal Toon, founder of the nonprofit group Faith for Change and author of God's Graffiti, Inspiring Stories for Teens. Welcome. Ramal, let me start with you. There were some very angry reactions to the verdict in the Zimmerman case, and the president of the National Black Church Initiative said that it gave any white male who felt threatened the license to kill young black boys. What did you make of that reaction?
Well, I think at the core of the anger, the root of it was sadness. The verdict really said to young African-American males that you don't matter. And so that sadness and that continued rejection by society then led to the anger that then led to some of the behavior we saw in the communities.
What other kinds of reactions have you been hearing, Kim?
Well, a mix, you know, as in society. But I've been really surprised by the level of calls for conversation coming out of this. And especially in the faith community, there's been, seems like a real coming together of people saying, we should talk about these issues no matter what we felt about the verdict. We want to see a new dialogue in this country precisely to address some of the pain that Ramal was talking about and some of the injustice and all of those divisions that persist.
Ramal, what kind of dialogue could be productive now, and what is the role of the faith community in stirring up that dialogue?
Right. I think the dialogue that should be had specifically in the faith community is how do we really go about being this community of faith that is multicultural and diverse and equal. But with that, moving from the conversation and looking at action steps, we really have to address how we're going to engage inner city youth and really meet the needs of the underserved. So the conversation needs to be twofold in terms of looking to identify how we can be more diverse and equal and embrace our differences, but then also addressing the needs of teenagers in the inner city.
And I was really surprised this week by some of the new voices I've been hearing in some of these issues that Ramal's talking about. Even in the Southern Baptist Convention, which is politically pretty conservative, race hasn't been at the top of their agenda until recently. But hearing from them calls, yes, for prayer, but also some of their leaders talking about engaging issues like the disproportionate number of young African-American men in prison or on death row. Those are not issues you've heard from the Southern Baptist Convention a lot in, you know, in many areas of it in the past. And so it's interesting how this particular case has spurred conversation, but maybe some new action as well.
You know, Ramal, one of the things that makes this difficult, I suspect, is the continued sort of segregation of Sunday morning, if you will. The fact that, you know, blacks and whites don't worship together typically, and so they don't know each other in this context. Does that have to change, and how could it change?
It definitely has to change. I think when we look at the gospel and we look at what the kingdom of heaven really looks like, it is not segregated. The kingdom of God is inclusive. It's culturally diverse. in order to overcome some of the issues we have now on Sunday morning, we really have to address issues of power and leadership within congregations. And what are we really perpetuating with the gospel? Are we really seeking to be an example of the kingdom on earth? Or are we unconsciously and perhaps in some ways consciously living in our silos? But it really requires some real hard conversations about race in this country.
And some of those have to start with relationships. And like you said, I did hear a lot this week people saying that there aren't enough relationships between communities where people can be honest and really address tough, tough issues and not just say, oh, we're all warm and fuzzy, but there are some deeper things that need to be addressed. And you can't start doing that if you don't have the relationship. So I did hear a lot of new calls for that as well.
Ramalk, your last thought, are you hopeful going forward?
I am hopeful. I think the gospel calls us to be hopeful, and it calls us to look at situations like this and answer the question of where is the evidence of God in these situations. And that answer is in how we engage communities and how we meet the needs of hurting people. So I'm always hopeful as long as that we know congregations are out there seeking to meet the needs of young people.
Thank you so much, Ramal Toon and Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you. In other news, there was more sectarian violence in Iraq this week as attacks during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan continued. Bombings carried out against both Sunnis and Shiites have killed nearly 200 people in the 2 weeks since Ramadan began. Iraq was already experiencing a wave of violence that put 2013 on track to be the country's deadliest year in the past five. A British TV channel has stirred up controversy by broadcasting the Muslim call to prayer each morning during Ramadan. Some critics said the move by Channel 4 could inflame tensions, coming less than 2 months after the murder of a British soldier in London. Two Muslim converts who are British citizens have been charged with that crime. It was hardly the first case of religious violence in England, where, as David Tereschuk reports, a government program designed to prevent extremism has had mixed results.
The bombing of the Boston Marathon came as a horrifying shock to many Americans. To some overseas observers, though, it came as no great surprise.
I think the United States has been behind us in this respect. The United States has always regarded, certainly, jihadist terrorism as something that comes at it from the outside. But it doesn't. You've got to swallow a bit of pride and say, yes, we have a homegrown problem.
Great Britain's governments have had long experience over decades of terrorism from within their own country, some of it with a religious dimension. The northern English city of Manchester in 1996. Surveillance video captures a truck bomb planted by the Irish Republican Army, predominantly Roman Catholics fighting against British authorities and against Britain's loyalist, mainly Protestant supporters, who then controlled Northern Ireland. Peace agreements eventually ended the IRA's bloody assaults. But on a single day in 2005, July 7th, London's transportation system was targeted in a new spate of terror attacks, mounted this time by a team of suicide bombers. One of them chose an everyday emblem of London, a double-decker bus. A number 30. The explosion ripped off the roof and blew apart passengers toward the back of the bus.
700 people were injured that day. These 52 pillars represent the 52 people killed. It was all the work of four people, four young men, all Muslims, all British born.
For violent jihadism to emerge from among Britain's Muslims was not unexpected by close observers of that population. The 3 million-strong Muslim community began immigrating in substantial numbers during the 1960s onward, mainly from South Asia. But younger generations have been born in the UK, and many have become deeply disaffected amid the country's economic troubles.
So youth unemployment is a significant issue. At the same time, there's significant numbers of people going into higher education and into university. So what you then have are very highly skilled, highly trained young people who are then finding it difficult to secure employment in the graduate jobs market, which again creates a huge degree of frustration.
Mainstream Muslim leaders say they fear the impact of violent extremists upon such alienated young Muslims. The spokesman for one of the country's biggest mosques is Salman Farsi.
There are certain groups that are extremely divisive. They can influence young people from our community, and eventually, you know, this can lead to all kinds of problems, and, you know, it can lead to terrorism.
The British government has developed a strategy they codename PREVENT. The mission of PREVENT is, and I quote, to respond to the ideological challenge of terrorism, to prevent people from being drawn into terrorism, and to work with sectors and institutions where there are risks of radicalization. The leaders of mosques and community groups naturally emphasize that the Prophet Muhammad's concept of jihad does not mean terrorism. Indeed, jihad can refer to an internal spiritual struggle. And so even young Muslims who are seriously opposed to national authorities and non-Muslim institutions can be helped to take the path of peaceful expression of their views. This is what the British government is banking on, and it claims some success in diverting angry young Muslims away from violence. Britain's oldest military and security think tank is run by Michael Clark, who frequently consults with the government.
There have been several hundred successful examples of, they call it intervention, where they say that somewhere like 500 or 600 people have been identified, have been encouraged to go in a different direction.
Mosque leaders, however, are less enthusiastic, since their congregations complain that the PREVENT strategy simply stigmatizes their faith, and of course only theirs.
It seemed as if that policy was just made to target the Muslim community, and now that's not very helpful, because the Muslim community will feel singled out for things that are beyond their control.
That sense of being profiled as potential terrorists has, for many in the community, been mingled with suspicion that Muslims are expected to act as spies, a drawback to the policy that the government has begun to acknowledge.
One of the problems that PREVENT always has is that it can be presented as giving information to the government and the authorities. And so PREVENT has got to be offered in a way that does not make vulnerable those people who are trying to help, make them look as if they're just giving intelligence information to the police.
It's feared now that violent extremists have turned away from the mainstream mosque environment.
The locus of organisation changed. Instead of radicalising in the mosques and sometimes in the local community groups, they started to radicalise in the bookshops and the sports clubs, and that's where it now is.
For British Muslims who are concerned about their rights being infringed and who value their activist bookstores and other forms of free expression, the PREVENT policy is a further sign that Muslims are being treated as second-class citizens.
We are promoting people to get involved in youngsters to go and get involved in politics and vote and so forth. But with the Muslim community youth, we are saying, look, don't have grievances. Don't raise issues regarding Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth. If you do, you're going towards becoming extremist. In a modern democracy, it really is outrage.
What is agreed among the more radical critics, many mosque representatives and independent analysts, is that there's a central flaw to PREVENT. Though intended as an attempt at dialogue, it's seen as overwhelmingly a matter of state security, and it overlooks what Muslims themselves are often most concerned with.
You can't come along to a local community that you haven't engaged with for 15, 20, 30 years and suddenly say to them, well, yeah, there's this big issue that we want you to address and please come and help us, without then addressing some of the issues that they have. So their greatest concerns may be around youth unemployment, educational underachievement or poor housing.
Britain's Conservative-led coalition government is also criticised by its own supporters over PREVENT. Engagement and discussion with potentially violent opponents is essentially wrong-headed, these critics say. And whatever success there's been in avoiding more July 7th type attacks has resulted from old-fashioned police work.
The way to try to solve this problem is not to get involved in the theological debate, not to get involved in domestic or foreign policy debates at endless amounts of mosques or Islamic societies and so on, but simply make it very clear where your own societal values are and where you draw those lines.
A line was dramatically crossed this year when two British-born Muslims and self-proclaimed jihadists, in this case from Nigerian backgrounds, butchered a soldier to death in a London neighbourhood. Evidently, neither old-fashioned police work nor the PREVENT strategy was able to stop this horror from happening. Counter-terrorism experts, including those broadly in support of PREVENT, know there will always be some attacks that cannot be forestalled, including both Britain's latest atrocity in May and America's in April. And that sobering assessment appears to be shared by President Obama as well.
One of the dangers that we now face are self-radicalized individuals who are already here in the United States. Those are in some ways more difficult to prevent.
It is absolutely the case that the Boston bombers were so low down the threat spectrum that they would not have triggered a PREVENT intervention in the United Kingdom. So our PREVENT strategy would almost certainly wouldn't have picked them up. PREVENT strategies cannot prevent everything.
Any country fearing attack may well have to start looking even more carefully, as Britain has, within its own population to identify and prevent extremist threats. But those threats will increasingly come from individuals with little group allegiance, and so it will likely get harder and harder to counter them effectively. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is David Tereschuk in London.
Catholic bishops in Britain denounced that country's decision this week to legalize same-sex marriage. The Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury also had opposed the law, warning that a redefinition of marriage would undermine the cornerstone of society. The Church of England is banned from performing same-sex marriages, but under the new legislation, other houses of worship can choose to do so. New data finds that more Americans are religious moderates than anything else. The Public Religion Research Institute says almost 4 in 10 Americans hold moderate religious views, compared to about 30% who are religious conservatives and about 20% religious progressives. 15% are not religious. The largest single group among progressives are Catholics, and among conservatives, white evangelical Protestants. The religious landscape of the United States is being reshaped by the explosive growth of the Latino population. 1 in 6 Americans today is of Hispanic origin, and that number is expected to double by 2050. What's changing in the Latino community is the once predictable dominance of the Catholic Church. These days, Hispanics are flocking to evangelical Protestant denominations. Worship begins at 2 on Sunday afternoons at this Assembly of God Church in suburban Washington, D.C. Hours later, it's still going, the sanctuary packed with congregants praying in rapid-fire Spanish. Membership at Iglesia Cuadrangular El Calvario has doubled in less than 2 years. The pastor says most of those who come are immigrants from Central America and former Catholics.
A lot of people, they call themselves like Catholic and on this case, but most of it because of tradition, but they really don't know anything about it.
What these worshipers do know is that they found a home in this evangelical Protestant church.
They like to be feeling free, you know, freedom to worship the Lord, especially with our heart. The way the Lord likes it when we do it with all our heart.
Most Hispanics in the United States still call themselves Catholic. They make up an increasing proportion of the church. Over the past 15 years, the number of Catholic churches offering Mass in Spanish has tripled to more than a quarter of all parishes.
The response never seems to be enough for the numbers, because every time a parish opens the door and welcomes immigrants, it's filled up. The influx of immigrant Catholics has kept the Catholic Church membership, you know, around 70 million. That's definitely a trend.
Almost half of Catholics under 40 are Latinos, according to the Pew Research Center. But the church's hold on second and third generation Hispanics is not as strong. Just 40% of Latinos whose grandparents were not born here say they are Catholic, while 30% now call themselves Protestant.
I hear people come to our church and say, "What time is Mass?" Or they call me Father. So I know they come from the Catholic. And they just said, "You know, it's just so different. I love it here. I feel like you're talking to me. I don't feel like it's just so rigid."
Wilfredo de Jesus became pastor of New Life Covenant Church in Chicago a dozen years ago.
Born in Chicago to a Puerto Rican mother, De Jesus, like many in his congregation, is not fluent in Spanish.
Our primary language is English, yet we still love our culture. We still love our rice and beans. We still love our music. But we love to hear the Word of God in the language that we can understand.
Under De Jesus, the church added services in English and experienced explosive growth.
We have to obey God's command, whether we like it or not.
New Life is now the biggest Assembly of God church in the country, drawing more than 17,000 worshipers a week at multiple campuses. Many grew up Catholic, but found in evangelical churches something they longed for.
Every time that I come to a service, I always get something new. I always have something to work towards, you know. I feel like the love and of everybody, like we're like a family, and I feel just welcomed and appreciated.
I think it's just that personal touch. It's about you being with God, you being with Jesus, and you having that personal relationship with him, and how that affects the rest of your life and every single day, every single minute, every single hour, and how do you use all of that to reach out to the communities, to reach out to the world.
New Life calls itself a church for the hurting, providing shelter for these women as well as food, clothing, and support to many people in need, and jobs at a cafe run by the church. Marilyn Garcia came here after 13 years of drug and alcohol abuse and now runs a New Life ministry for women.
What would have happened to you, do you think, had you not found this place?
I would have been dead, you know. I would have definitely been dead. Towards the end of my addiction, I was too much of a wimp to commit suicide, but I was drinking my life away. I was having unprotected sex with multiple men. I was working the streets as a prostitute, which I did for 5 years.
New Life's success is visible throughout this Chicago neighborhood, where the crime rate has dropped as the church has grown. Pastor De Jesus believes any church can have a similar impact in its community, so he's sharing his playbook. You are welcome in
this place, oh God. 300 pastors and church leaders from across the country attended New Life's third annual conference to learn how to jumpstart their ministries from the man people call Pastor Choco.
God is saying, I've got the money. I got the resources. What I need is a church that's willing to meet the needs of these people. Is that you? Is that you?
We're a congregation today of about 100. And we see bigger things ahead of us. We see greater things ahead of us. And we're here to see and learn from Pastor Choco what he's done and how we can utilize some of the models that he's implemented to further God's kingdom.
We want to grow, but we really want to rebuild and really touch the hurting. And so that's our focus right now.
What have you learned so far?
Right now, what I've learned is that if Pastor Choco can do it, we can do it.
The pastors also learned firsthand how New Life ministers to the homeless.
Hello? God bless you, sir. How are you?
Some believe the election of the first Latin American pope could help the Catholic Church retain more Hispanics.
I think that symbolically it is very meaningful. However, we cannot expect every Hispanic Catholic immigrant to remain Catholic as they enter into U.S. society. However, I think that the Catholic bishops will continue to open up the doors so that Catholic immigrants from Latin America and other continents will find in the Catholic Church their home away from home.
I'm not asking you to join my church. You can join any church you want. But you need to learn how to wait on the Lord. If you raise your hand, would you do me a favor? Get out of your seat and come quickly. Come.
And they do come, forming a new community united in prayer. More of them every week.
In the name of Jesus. In the name of Jesus.
Pope Francis leaves next week on his first major international trip. He'll travel to Brazil, home to the world's largest Catholic population, to celebrate World Youth Day. The Pope will pray at the National Shrine of Our Lady of Aparecida, the largest shrine in the world dedicated to the Virgin Mary. He'll also lead the Stations of the Cross on the famous Copacabana beach and visit a slum in Rio de Janeiro. Can following the Pope on Twitter be good for your soul? The Vatican says that following World Youth Day events on social media can lead to a plenary indulgence, which Catholics believe can reduce the time a soul spends in purgatory. But it's not that easy. The same requirements for participation, devotion, and contrition apply in real life and online. That's our program for now. I'm Deborah Potter. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, including audio and video podcasts of this program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more music from the Iglesia Cuadrangular El Calvario.
Así lo quiero hacer, dígalo, no importando cómo me puedan ver. Así lo quiero hacer, no importando cómo me puedan ver. Así lo quiero hacer.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be More. PBS.